Start Me Up podcast, part of the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network in association with MSW Media. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in D.C. Today, my guest is Amanda Wiss. She's an actress. You've seen her in everything. Some of her films include Fast Times at Ridgemont High. She played Bradley's girlfriend, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Better Off Dead, Silverado. She's been in a number of television shows. She's so cool, and she's friends with Jody Hamilton. So, of course, she's awesome people. We're going to talk mostly about her career and acting and all that good stuff. Maybe a little bit of a social issue thing, but we're not going to be heavily focusing on politics. We're just going to have a fun day. But before we get into our conversation, the Start Me Up podcast is independent, supported by listeners, and it's woman run. A great big thank you to everybody who supports the show. If you enjoy today's podcast, visit patreon.com/startmeup. Check out all the tiers. I do include a tier with a much shorter intro and no ads. You can hear the free shows on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they're followed up by What's Up, a show just for patrons where I talk about anything that comes to mind. It's a little more personal, kind of like my online diary. Visit patreon.com/startmeup. And don't forget, you can find Start Me Up on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever podcasts are found. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Amanda Wiss. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Thank you for having me.
As I hit my computer and probably made a noise. But I'm so excited to have you because, okay, let me just say, I know you're friends with Jody Hamilton, and Jody Hamilton is so loved on this show. And, you know, you and I were following each other on Twitter. And it's funny, my boyfriend, Bob Suska, you know, Jody's on his show every week. And I think when you started following me, I was like, look who's following me. I'm so excited. And so we're always talking about you and Jody, and you know, I think Jody is also friends with some different actors who are on Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which we're going to get to in a minute. But I just want to say thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Oh my gosh, and I'm excited to talk to you too, because just from social media, I'm such a huge fan of yours.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And so when this came about, I was very excited.
Well, and I know that I wanted to specifically ask you about your career, because your career is incredible. And of course, I have my own personal questions, but you've just been working forever and you've been in everything. And so I have a lot to ask you, and we might get to some politics. I've included some political questions just in case we don't fill up the time. But, you know, I figured we'd talk about your career, maybe throw in a few social issues. But just so everybody knows, I mean, I said it in the intro, but I mean, you've got this IMDb list that just goes on for miles. You've been working in the industry since the 1980s. You've done television, you've done film, you've done it all. And it's incredibly impressive. And it's just something, I mean, I used to be an actor, and anybody who would take a look at what you've accomplished who wants to be an actor would think, well, that's, I mean, outside of, you know, being like, I don't know, Meryl Streep, your career is something that so many people lust after and want, because you just have all this consistent work. And I've got all these questions prepared. So I'm going to start off with the fact that I read that you were raised in Manhattan Beach. Is that correct?
Yes.
So what was that like for you? I grew up in, I experienced 4 years in Torrance, California, so I'm familiar with the area. So what was it like for you growing up in Manhattan Beach?
Oh my gosh. First of all, that's so funny, Torrance, because that, especially, you know, when I grew up there, you know, 1,000 years ago, it was a really small, close community, all those little beach towns.
Yeah.
But literally, it was like growing up in a Beach Boys song.
Yeah.
And they, you know, were from Carson, and right there, I mean, they're a little bit older than me, but not, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so like my family, we weren't very sophisticated. I was like a total rube. I could have been like from just anywhere. I didn't go on an airplane till I was 17. I thought Hollywood was like a day's drive away. I just literally wasn't very sophisticated. But it was fantastic growing up. You know, we were outdoors the whole time, mm-hmm. and always at the beach. Mm-hmm. And you know, always tan and roller skating and playing volleyball. And I mean, it was just a very athletic, outdoorsy, you know, pretty wholesome, aside yeah. from all the teen drinking, pretty wholesome upbringing and drugs. Yes. Aside from the teen drinking and drugs.
Yes.
It was a super wholesome upbringing.
Yeah. Been there, done that. It's funny because my mom moved me around my whole life. We moved to Torrance when I was 15. And up until, I think it was 10th grade, I had never lived anywhere for more than 2 years. So, and I had lived in Silver Lake and Laurel Canyon and LA proper and just all over. And so when we had been living in Hollywood, and there was just this particular, like real quick, I'll just say I had a friend, and unfortunately, her single mother was raped. And her single mother, my mom felt sorry for this woman. She didn't like her. But she felt sorry for her, and we all wound up living together in Hollywood in this house. Actually, right up, if you know where Dharmagreb is, I think AFI is on the other side of it.
Yeah.
It's that Stanley Street. We lived on Stanley. And at that particular time, there were, like, hookers in front of the 7-Eleven that was right down the street. And my girlfriend and I think we were, like, 13, 14 years old. We were, you know, like, pimps were talking to us. It was just not a very good situation for a young girl. So my mother decided, okay, I'm going to take her down with this horrible situation with our roommate. So my mom moved us to Torrance because it was just, like you said, so wholesome. And I loved it. And it was so funny because it's like everything you said. It was the beach experience. It was kind of like, I never thought about it, but it was like growing up in a Beach Boy song. I had 4 years of it, but it was so wonderful. And then eventually when I was older, I think I was like, I was just graduating from high school, and my mother decided to move back up to Hollywood. And I was so disappointed, and I was like, Torrance is a little piece of heaven. And then I had a lot of fun in Hollywood. But anyway, so I totally know what that must have been like for you. Plus, you're like the total California blonde beach girl type, and so you would fit in just perfectly. okay. Oh, wait, go ahead. Did you have anything
No. I was going to say my younger sister is like a fair-skinned redhead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back when we were kids, the only sunblock that was even invented, I think, was See and Ski, and it was a 7. And how she isn't just riddled with the horribleness, because she's so beautiful. Aww. And she just had this little like white yeah. skin, and you know, and she always was like, I just want to get tan. I'm like, stop it, you're never gonna tan, it's not gonna happen.
So okay, let me ask you, when did you start acting? When did you know you wanted to be an actor?
My older sister was at UCLA, and she decided to major in theater arts, which it was just not even something on any of our radar, really. Mm-hmm. And she, so I was, I don't know, 9 or 10 when she was at UCLA, and I went to see a couple of plays that she did, like The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and I was really young, and I went, this is amazing. And so I asked her if she could help me audition for a play, because there was a theater in LA that was doing The Innocents by William Inge, and so she drove me there, and I auditioned, and I got it.
Wow.
And so that was just amazing. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was working with these wonderful older actors, and it was double cast because we were kids. Mm-hmm. And it just turned out to be the most amazing experience to sort of unzip my own skin and step into someone else's skin suit and know what that, try to find the truth and reality in that circumstance. And then the following year, I think I was 11, I played at the same theater I did The Bad Seed. I played Rhoda, and there was a one night my dad came to see it, and there was a reviewer from the LA Times behind him, and the story goes that he leaned over to his companion and said, "I wouldn't let that little bitch in my house for all the money in the world."
Wow.
I know. So my dad was like, "Well, she's doing a good job."
So, that's awesome.
So that's when I knew. I knew if I could fool the adults. No. I loved memorizing the lines. Hmm. I loved the rehearsal process, and I loved watching the older actors and hearing their stories. And this on a side note, it makes me, I feel for younger actors coming up now and filmmakers mm-hmm. in general, because they don't have the same desire to hear the lore from older actors or writers or directors. They, for some reason, you know, I think everything's so readily available on Google that that they can get a fact and they don't need a personal story attached to it. Mm-hmm. Because I found that I learned so much about acting from sitting around listening to actors tell stories about plays they did and years in summer stock and working on movies with so-and-so and you know, and up until cell phones, everybody would sit around on sets, you know, mm-hmm. on your set, even mm-hmm. for the most part, you communicated with other actors a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. That's pretty sad. I guess everything changes, so there's going to be good and bad with everything. But yeah, that whole, you know, what I remember when I was little, and I didn't have any idea at this point what I wanted to do, but a friend of mine was in a play, and I saw it, and I enjoyed the play, but what really, like, struck me was after the play, there was that camaraderie between the actors, and because I had the opportunity, my friend was in the play, I had the opportunity to kind of go with her and watch all the other actors interact, and I saw this camaraderie that was just so appealing, and it was so very specific to creativity, and it was like all these people have to trust each other. And then once they come together, they do this performance and they trust each other. And when they're finished, it's this huge accomplishment. And then there is this, like, I don't know, this amazing feeling of gratitude, of unity, of family. And that was so appealing to me. Is that another part of the aspect of acting that drew you in?
Yes. So well said. And, you know, I came from a very disruptive family, and you know, it started when I was a kid. My older brother passed away from an illness, and just things sort of fell apart, and people left, and you know, it was a very disrupted, you know, fearful. Mm-hmm. I felt very lost a lot of the time, and as a kid, being in that play, I felt so nurtured and seen, and it mattered. Mm-hmm. It mattered that I showed up.
Yeah.
Like, people knew where I was. Like, I had accountability where, you know, I think a lot of my home life, I felt that nobody would even know whether I was there.
Wow.
And so it was just neat to have that connection with people, and that it was important that I was important to the process that we were all involved in. But you're right. It was a, you know, it's the family of choice in any given, you know, production that you do. And I still love that to this day. I love that feeling of, you know, that camaraderie and work family.
Yeah. That's definitely, I think, one of the best parts of it, that in my experience. Now, you said that you just went and auditioned for this play. You had no training prior to that?
No.
Wow, that's
amazing.
I
mean, other than I played Snoopy in the fourth grade production of the Peanuts when I was, you know,
that's awesome,
in Ms. Henderson's class at Grandview Elementary.
Did you ever study acting formally? Was your education on the stage? How did that go?
I did study formally, and I have on and off my entire career, just because, you know, if I'm having a year where I'm not working very much, it's nice to have a place to go and put up some scenes and get some, you know, well-loved critique. Nobody likes being critiqued. Right. But I took theater in mm-hmm. high school, and then I after high school I studied for 2 years at Lee Strasberg Institute in Hollywood, and Sally Kirkland was my teacher.
Oh, how
she
fascinating!
Was one of my teachers. Yeah.
I worked with her on Days of Our Lives. That's so funny.
Yeah, yeah, she was intense.
I bet.
You know, especially to my 18-year-old eyes, she was just so intense. Like she intense. She was very much that you had to be in complete control of your body because it was your tool for everything, and if you're going to cry, you need to be able to shed a tear out of your right eye and then your left eye, or both eyes. It's really much that you had to be in control of your instrument.
Right.
And, you can make yourself throw up on stage. Things like that, that were a little intense, but,
yes,
but we're still friends and I adore her. And then later I studied with, Larry Moss.
Okay.
And who's wonderful. And then
what kind of acting does he teach?
It's a hybrid, I would say. It's not as much the sense memory and stuff as Strasberg mm-hmm. was. It was more a hybrid, but it would use that, and he would do things to get you distracted out of your head, and it was a little Meisner-ish. It was mm-hmm. But it was closer to Strasberg than not. Hmm. And then I recently for years studied with this wonderful, wonderful teacher here in LA named Stuart Rogers, and his is a definite hybrid of imagination work mm-hmm. and it's just a fantastic class and a lot of scene study. And the funny thing was, because I had a mad crush in high school on Al Pacino, and when and he studied with Strasberg, so come on,
right?
And
exactly.
So I watched him on the Actor's Studio once, and he was talking about how he had done all the those techniques and sense memory and dredging things up and doing all this work, and then one day he went, I'm just gonna use my imagination. And I thought it was so funny because I literally had started studying with a teacher, Stuart Rogers, who was like, just use your imagination.
Yeah,
which but I have all those tools in my toolbox from all the other things I learned, and they're great because often, especially like in television and you're moving so fast, I just find you have to have a lot of tools in your toolbox mm-hmm. because sometimes there's a scene that you don't know how to make it work and you need to be able to mm-hmm. go someplace in you that can access something to do and make that scene work so you can help tell the story.
Right. In my opinion. Do you, this is just a random question I just thought of, but do you feel like, because I studied Meisner, and with Meisner, there is something called repetition, and basically you're just looking at there's all forms of doing repetition because you can do an improv repetition with a theme, but then you can also just start it you're both standing there and you're looking at each other in each other's eyes, and you start off with something. And so that could be like, I feel nervous. And then you would say back to me, you feel nervous? I feel nervous. You have to repeat it at least once, and you have to only focus on emotions, what I'm feeling, what I think you're feeling, or I could, if we were going to do it together, that it would be recognizing something, you look worried or something physical about them. But for instance, if you just say, fuck you, if somebody in my acting class was doing something like that, my coach would say, conversational. And mainly what you had to say was, I'm angry with you, because fuck you doesn't mean anything, but I'm angry with you. And so what I'm leading up to is, because I've had this training, I feel like it's almost like studying human psychology. And I know that obviously Meisner is one way to do it, but what I have found is that I'm really, really, really good at reading people in real life. And sometimes it's very, it can be frustrating because I can read people so well and they don't necessarily read themselves so well. And I feel like I understand more about them than they do, psychologically speaking, and it can be frustrating. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience.
First of all, that's, really fascinating, and I didn't know that about you. But I had taken a Meisner workshop, and so I didn't end up taking the whole class, but I thought the repetition was amazing. I never took it far enough to really get it. I'd go see, was it Spoon River was the play they always did here? And I would just love how real everybody was. But I can totally see that in those repetition practices or exercises, you really are, I mean, you're reading your own emotion, but you're really focused on the other person. And I think for acting, also it translates to real life. I think often actors know their lines and they're just waiting for you to speak so they can speak. And I think Meisner is great at making you be so focused on listening to the other person that your responses just become so organic. And but I think sometimes as actors, because we are observers all the time, we can tend to see who people are. I mean, I think, I mean, maybe not always, but I think that, I'm just going to say a thousand times. I think
That's fine.
I think that we all are capable of reading people. There's what those books, like The Tipping Point, in those books that say people read you in 20 seconds. They know who you are. And it's a great lesson for actors going on auditions or just people showing up in life, that when we're not authentic, people feel it. They do, they might not know why they don't like us or why they're uncomfortable, but it's that we can read each other on some animal level.
Somebody's,
you know, I mean, I used to do it. I used to think, oh, it'd be so much cooler if I did this. And I'd walk into a room and people are like, next. And, you know, I work because what I have is unique to me. And if I try to be or do anything different, it's inauthentic. And it doesn't mean I can't play other characters. But, you know, on auditions, the first when you walk in, if I'm like, oh, I'm so cool, because I'm not, I'm like such a doofus that it just makes people uncomfortable. They're like, why is she lying, walking in the room lying?
How interesting. It's just, I loved, you know, my experience with it. I was in a Meisner studio for 8 years, and I just I loved it so much, and I actually loved that more than I loved the business. And I didn't get far enough into the business to have the experience of fully loving the business. I got, you know, it's funny because after I left, I made a decision to leave my acting studio, and then I thought I might get back into it, and I never really did. But I met this woman who got invited to all these Hollywood parties. I always call them like the Hollywood B-listers. Occasionally I went to A-list parties, but it was mostly like the B-listers. And I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder because I just felt that Hollywood was full of shit. And I would tell people, I would lie and say I was 40 just to watch the shock on their face that I would be on. You know, I was like 34 at the time. And because I'm tall and I was 6 feet tall, I weighed, and I was quite slender. But I weighed like 150 pounds, big bones and everything. And I would tell everybody that I weighed 150 pounds just to watch them completely freak out. And it was kind of freeing for me because I my entire existence as an actor, I loved the process. I took it seriously. I showed up on time to my auditions. I made sure that I was dressed appropriately, had my lines. I was always taking it seriously. And I loved my acting studio. But I think the thing that got in my way was my opinion of myself, because I am 6 feet tall. I have broad shoulders. I've big bones, and I didn't fit the Hollywood mold. And I think I hated my body so much. And I also dealt with acne. So it was like acne and not being as thin as I wanted to be and not being as small as most of the actresses were. I just spent so much time hating myself. And I like when you talk about that I think like people read that energy from me and they weren't necessarily sure what to do with me. And I didn't stay in it. You know, I decided to leave. And then it's funny because when I left, I look back and I'm so grateful for that experience. And I'm almost grateful that I didn't get anywhere farther, because I think I would have, I mean, I developed an eating disorder and I was so hard on myself. I can't imagine what I would have done to myself if I had actually become successful and the pressure. And that's what I want to ask you about. As a woman in this business, what kinds of pressures have you felt, whether it's about body image or sexism? And you don't have to name names or anything like that, but just general, basically generalities of this business. As a woman, like, what are the big takeaways, good and bad?
Well, hearing you say that about, the feelings and thoughts you had about yourself, it just is so heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes beyond the industry. It's society.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I used to have people, and I'm pretty thin, would be like, she's too athletic, or she's too this. And then if I was really thin, people would be like, now she looks sickly.
Yeah.
And so it was just always this weird thing about how I looked.
Yeah.
And I think that, on a large scale, society does that to women, and then yes, the entertainment industry just takes it and runs. And I remember being like 26 and my agent saying, well, if you don't get a big break soon, it's over.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, nothing's going to happen for your career. And I was like, well, I just want to be a journeyman actor. I don't have to be the lead in things. Mm-hmm. I want to do character work. And like, you're too pretty for character work, which isn't true.
No.
And I've made my whole career,
yes,
being the friend, or, the crazy murderer, or the crazy person who gets murdered, or the senator's wife, but she used to be a hooker. The loving mom who's also a heroin addict. But I don't know what that says about me, but I never play a character that's just straight up
right,
anything. She's always like, there's always some like crazy secret. But anyway, I think that, yes, yeah, I never felt pretty enough. So much scrutiny. And mm-hmm, what happened to you, when I was in my 30s, I got adult acne. And I remember I was working on a TV show in Canada, and people were just so unkind about it.
Wow.
Like, during my lunch hour, they would bring me to the set, and the gaffer and the DP would be like bitching about how the hell they were going to try to light me, and,
oh my God,
and stuff. And I was just like, do I need to be here for this? Just like, right, put a whiteboard up there with red dots on it, try to make it look better. But I think it's hard to maintain a sense of self when you start really young as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you started, it sounds like, very young, and I definitely started young. I mean, because from an early age, mm-hmm, I had to be accountable for my talent, but it was a lot about how I looked, and mm-hmm, it always felt I was falling short or disappointing people, or getting horrible feedback from people about, you didn't get that part because you're not pretty enough. Like, oh, who tells a teenager that?
Wow.
It's just mean. And I think that society does that too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, they've done studies that a prettier, woman will get the job over,
yes,
and we do make it hard on like a tall woman,
mm-hmm,
who's gorgeous and Amazonian. And I would aspire to that, because I've just got the tiny Irish leprechaun look. But I think that this business also, everybody's patting themselves on the back right now about, mm-hmm, like, oh, there's so many streaming platforms, and there's all this stuff, and so many women are working. Well, you know what? It's all the same women.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's like 10 women in their 40s and 50s, and they're all on like 10 TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then, occasionally somebody like me gets to do an episode.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just call bullshit on,
yeah,
all of that. And
yeah,
that people aren't like, I'm not even reading for all these cool new shows, because they're straight up offers to the same 10
wow,
women that do all of them. So I just think we haven't made any progress. We just have spread it out further.
Mm.
Instead of it being like one anointed woman, it's now 10.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I don't think we're making a lot of progress. I mean, I guess it is progress, but I haven't felt it. I was just talking to somebody the other day, and they're like, God, you must go on so many auditions. And I'm like, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
There's only two casting companies that call me in.
Wow.
Of all the casting directors out there. And you just go, wow, this business is so hard on
it
your,
is.
Just to keep going. But the people that do love me offer me great roles, and I'm super stoked about that because I just love doing what I do. I just love it. Just from soup to nuts, I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I talked to Kirsten Warren. I don't know if you know who she is. I can't speak.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, she was on the show, and she was talking about how, because she's in her 50s now, you know, back in the day, in her 20s and 30s, of course, she was, you know, going on tons of auditions a week, and now she gets maybe one or two a month. And it's because of her age. And, you know, and it's so, and even her husband, Kirk Acevedo, you know, I mean, it's like, I've had him on my show and I've had Vincent D'Onofrio on my show. I love both of those guys. But Vincent D'Onofrio is a white male, and he is, I mean, I swear to God, that guy, every time you turn around, he's got 50 new movies coming out. And Kirk, yeah, who is also a very good actor, who is Puerto Rican, you know, it's totally different, the kind of roles that he's offered. You know, we like to think that Hollywood is so liberal, but it's really not so liberal. It loves to stereotype
you. No, it isn't, and it is hard, you know, getting... Well, first of all, like, I really wish I could fully embrace the... I love... who I am today, so my age is great, and mm-hmm. and I mean, and I do to some extent, but it is, you know, harder mm-hmm. because in the sense of work, because even women my age, and I'm in my 60s, is that they still want a 40-year-old playing mm-hmm. the 60-year-old.
Yes.
Something, I can't quite figure it out, or they're like, well, you don't look old enough to, and I'm like, but I am, and I do have I represent some, you know,
yeah,
part of the people that are 60. So I'm getting used to saying I'm 60. That's why I'm announcing it. I wanted to roll off my tongue like right. you at the party saying you're 40 when you weren't, but I am actually 60. But I just think, yeah, you know, I'm like, I thought this would be the years I'd be playing like the kooky grandma or the right. crazy aunt. And then I see the shows, and it's I don't even know. It's there again. There's like 10 people that do all the parts.
Exactly.
And I'm not
yeah.
one of them. I'm not on the short list for some reason.
Wow. And I mean, God, we're going to get to your movies in a minute because I have questions, but there's so many other things I'm thinking about. I watched I think it's called The Dark Side of the 90s. I think it's on Hulu, and it's this documentary. It's not really dark, but basically it's just a whole bunch of themes, and it's a documentary. So one of the shows that I watched recently was Television. And it focused primarily on Baywatch. And I thought it was fascinating because here I was, I started to study acting around 1990, 91. And my studio, it was like a 2.5-year course. So I didn't want to start auditioning before I knew what I was doing. And I didn't, so I'd say maybe my auditioning years started around 1993, 1994-ish or whatever. So that's when I was really in the thick of it and really wanting it and feeling the pressures. And so this show was focusing on other shows, but primarily Baywatch, talking about how Pamela Anderson coming onto that show and then all of a sudden getting breast implants, it all over the United States, teenage girls, or not teenage, college-age girls and older, were getting I think it like went up 500%. And then not only that,
wow.
the size of the implants were up 40%, basically to match her size. And then interestingly enough, when she decided to leave and then had her breast implants taken out, a whole bunch of those people also had theirs taken out. And so it just goes to show you how we are like a nation of freaking sheep following people we admire. But one of the things that I remember I so desperately, because of my body image, and again, I was slender, but I was never skinny. Like I've had Kristen Johnston on the show from Third Rock, and I auditioned to be her stand-in when Third Rock was just not even, it was called Life as We Know It, and I didn't want the fucking job. I got, it was a thing where I could audition for these roles in union, and I was not in a union, and my whole goal was to get a SAG card, so you had to have 3 auditions, and that audition was, I think, my last one, and I didn't want the job. But here she was also 6 feet tall, and I mean when I was my thinnest and felt my best, I was 150. They wanted me to be 125, and I'm sure Kristen was closer to that. I think she was probably close, she's probably like 130 because her bones are smaller. And it all sounds so ridiculous and petty to worry about this, but it was everything in my eyes. It was like, I felt like she had the ideal tall body, and if I had a body like hers, I would be more successful. And you know, the Ally McBeal show was on, and Calista Flockhart, which I believe is probably a naturally thin woman, was so thin, and there was like the size zero came up in our generation, and I mean, I could never. I wore size 10. I could, even when I was so skinny, and as I think I the lowest weight I ever got to was like 147, and I had literally it's like you were saying, I had people coming up to me and saying, Kimberly, you look wrong. Something's wrong with you. You're too skinny, because my bones are so big that I can't get that thin, because it doesn't look attractive. It just looks wrong. And I wanted to write a book, and I remember I wanted to call it Diet, and I wanted to use the T as like a knife, like to represent like we're dying here to be skinny. And it was just so difficult. And I, you know, I mean, this generation, Gen X generation, is. You know, I mean, every generation is hard on themselves. There have been thin women in acting forever, but I think it really started getting crazy in the 90s with heroin chic, and so, and then it just like morphed into putting, you know, fillers in your face and stretching your face. And when I was 28 years old, I know this is an interview, it isn't about me, but I just like talking, it's like so interesting to talk to you. But when I was 28, I was a smoker, like a fucking idiot. And I remember I looked in the rearview mirror and I noticed that I had smile lines, which I've always had, but I never noticed them. And I was like, oh, and I thought, this is because I'm smoking and I have to stop smoking. And then I became obsessed with these fucking lines on my face that I've had since I was basically a kid. You know, it's like the way my face is shaped. It didn't really mean I was old. It just meant that that's how my face was shaped. But it's like, I can't even imagine what it's like to have a lifetime in that. I mean, granted, like, you know, you're saying you're very pretty and you're naturally thin, and but still, even you, like, no one would think, looking at you, that anyone would have anyone to complain about with your physical appearance. Like, you just fit the mold, but yet you still did.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? You hit so many points so perfectly. Every era, I think, it's, the entertainment industry and magazines hold a certain look up to the rest of the world. And then, we're just trained as women to want to live up to whatever it is that is before us. And oh my gosh, in the 80s, I, first of all, everybody had big boobs. And when I was coming up, 80s and 90s, and I'm completely flat chested. Sports bras are too big. And and so every show was about padding a bra and things. And at some point, I was like, this is just it. Like, I have a nice butt. I have a pretty big round butt. You're just going to have to like deal with those are my curves. That's it. Just on the backside. But it's hard. Like, you make deals with yourself. Like now, you know, so many people have already had multiple facelifts by my age, and their eyes done, and, you know, chemical peels and all that stuff. And I think it's all fantastic. Mm-hmm. People should 100% do what makes them happy. Mm-hmm. But in an industry that, you know, supposedly represents, and now we're trying to be representative of minorities, and how about representation of what an actual woman?
Yes. Yes. Oh my God. It's like, how can that?
I think that the, you know, like how you were saying, the young kids are, and now with Instagram models, and everybody uses a filter. I made myself stop using filters like 2 years ago. I was like,
wow, that's awesome.
For the love of God, I could be a grandmother. Just like, let it go. And it's so freeing. It's freeing. Yeah. And, but it's not, I don't have children. I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and I just feel for my nieces. Live world wants them to be airbrushed, and to have inflated everything, and that people look like cats. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't want to look like a cat. And like your forehead doesn't move or whatever. Right. And again, people should do, life is hard.
Yeah.
Do what floats your boat, make yourself happy.
Yeah.
I'm just talking specifically like in the entertainment industry though, we just don't represent, in my opinion, what a real woman looks like. And when we do see somebody on screen that you can tell hasn't, you know, frozen their face or whatever, it's such a delight to feel that mirrored back. And it makes me feel hopeful because it's hard, but aging is hard.
Yeah.
In my opinion, in a world that doesn't value older people that wants to put women out to pasture because you're not fuckable anymore. Mm-hmm. The 20-year-olds that are now running studios, they're like, ew,
right,
she's older than my grandmother.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I think it's kind of hard. And then there's a part of me that's gotten sassier and more comfortable in my own skin. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and it's a long, hard fought battle because
it is.
The world that we live in and the industry we live in. And, you know, and I mean, the former fucktard who was in office, just the way he talked about women and, you know, wanting to fuck his daughter and all these things he talked about, that's super representative of a whole lot of people. And so on top of him making my skin crawl to the point where Stephen, who I live with, knew that we had to mute it if his voice came on because it made me apoplectic. It sent me into a rage. And I couldn't even explain to Stephen the rage because it was some female animal, caveman, lizard brain anger of just being completely reduced to something some disgusting pervert wants to look at and touch.
Yes, it's
it makes me feel unsafe. And it's all happening all around us right now, you know, with the Supreme Court and with everything. It's like, I don't understand how we live in a country and for the most part a world that completely is terrified of women so much that they have to devalue us in some way in order for their dicks to get hard. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
It freaks me out.
Yes.
And the entertainment industry is a microcosm of that in many ways. And then in many ways not, but I think that there are people out there doing really great shows with and for a female audience. But
there needs to be more. Yeah.
And I'm only speaking about female, not minorities. And
there's
a lot of places in this industry that we need to do better.
Yes.
And be more representative and tell truthful stories. And I don't know. Now I'm rambling. Now I went off on a tangent.
That's the whole point.
That was my ramble, my unladen ramble.
Okay, well, since I do want to cover some of the things that you've done, and I haven't yet, because I could just talk to you all day about a million different subjects, but so was Fast Times at Ridgemont High like the biggest? I'm sure you acted before that, but was that the big break thing that you got?
Yes. I mean, I'd done a couple TV pilots that hadn't gone, and I'd done a rock star of a movie called Force 5 that was directed by Robert Klaus, who had directed Enter the Dragon. Mm. And so I was super excited, too, because I was very into martial arts growing up.
Wow.
And still, one of my guilty pleasures is watching martial art movies starring like Jeff Speakman and Cynthia Rothrock. So just if anybody else out there that they'll know that I really do like them.
Right.
But this movie, it was horrible and it was hilarious. And I literally wore a sheet that had been sewn into like a toga thing because I was kidnapped and kept in a cult. But anyway, so my next film after that was Fast Times.
Wow.
It was such a big step up. And it was so much fun. And my audition had just been an improv with Judge Reinhold in front of Amy and the Carrie Fraser, who was the casting director. And it was just so much fun, and we got to rehearse, which, back in the day, studio movies, you had time to rehearse. Mm-hmm. And so I was real comfortable with that, coming from, drama school and doing plays, that it was just such a, I was so shocked when that was kind of the last film I ever had rehearsals on.
Wow.
And it was just such a luxury to do improv with all the other actors and really live it before we actually started filming, and that was really exciting. And it was just a wonderful experience. And some of us are still friends from that. And so it was really exciting. Art Linson produced it, who's now producing Yellowstone in 1883. Right. And I really, really wish he would come back around to me for those shows, because I really like them. Wow. I'm like, hey, I do a good job.
Yeah.
I'd really like to do your shows. But it was a really great experience. And I feel like Cameron Crowe really captured, the beach life of a teenager. I mean, that.
Yeah.
You lived it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and first I'm going to tell my little story, but then I want to ask you about Sean Penn. But I think it's funny, because I wrote a book called Peyton's Choice, and basically it's about a teenager who has an abortion. And, I kind of modeled the idea. The story was a little bit more about just teen romance and first boyfriends and having sex for the first time. And one, like, the first real book I ever read was Forever by Judy Blume. I don't know did you ever read that book?
No, I haven't read that one.
It was just, it was Michael and Kath, and they had sex, and I was 10 when I, not, yeah, I was 10. And it was written by Judy Blume. So it was basically for, young people. I was a little young, but I was so fascinated. And anyway, I also, though, wanted to kind of take from Forever, and actually read Forever again before I wrote my book. But one of the other inspirations was Fast Times, because Jennifer Jason Leigh in that role had an abortion. And the best part of that storyline was that it really wasn't a big deal. It was just something that was available to her, and it informed teenagers like me. I'm 53 now. When I watched that movie, I just recognized that that was my right, and it was available to me. And I never knew anything different. I was born in 1968, so, I think I was very young when it became legal, and it was just natural for me. And growing up, my mother was always liberal. I have a single mom, but, just never even an issue. And so I wanted to be able to write a book in a similar vein as far as a young girl making this decision and having all the freedom to make that decision. But I really like that. But so anyway, I just had to throw that out there. And also, I'm pitching my book.
I'm going to read your book now. I did not know that. And I'm going to read it.
Well, it's interesting. I set it in Torrance, and I have the backdrop of everything there. I had a group of three friends, and we were best friends, the four of us. And even though I've never been pregnant, and yes, I did set this as my backdrop, a lot of it is really based on my experience, just slight tweaks here and there, so that's just fun to know. But I want to know, so obviously I remember that scene. I think you were just sitting behind Sean Penn when he got the pizza.
Yes.
I think so. So when, just curiously, because I freaking love, everyone loves Sean Penn in that movie. He's so fucking funny. And I love that movie so much. My boyfriend and I watch it at least once a year, and it's so much fun. I fucking love that movie. But Sean Penn is just brilliant. Did you recognize, when you were working with him, his brilliance? What did you think of him then?
Yes, I recognized that he just had access to an inner life that was huge and real and authentic and funny, and he was inspiring to watch and to be in scenes with. And he had a lot of freedom. He didn't censor himself, which I think as an actor, that's such a great thing to aspire to, because, you know, we all have that inner critic that will stop, but, you know, you don't want to look foolish or, you know, whatever your inner blockades are. he was, yes, you could just see he was just free and wild, and that was going to take him places.
Right.
You know, it was just so authentic and so real. And I always found him to be very charming and very nice. He was very nice to me.
Wow. Well, and he so reminds me of so many of I don't know if you're familiar with South High on Pacific Coast Highway, but that is the high school that I graduated from. And he totally represents so many. It was like a surfer stoner school. I mean, obviously, people.
Isn't that where he went to school?
I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know if he went to South High. I went to West High in the 10th grade.
Oh.
And then I went
Oh, no. He went to Santa Monica High.
Oh, okay. But I had the opportunity to go to, I don't know if you're at all familiar with West High in Torrance, but that was fucking crazy because everybody, I had never in my life experienced a school where, I mean, popularity is a thing in every school. It was off the charts in the school. And it was about how you looked and how you dressed, and everybody had their role. You were either new romantic or you were, you know, like a rocker, or and you had to fit in one of those molds. And it was just crazy. But then I went to South High, and I remember there was this kid in my school named Tyler. And, I mean, he was basically our Jeff Spicoli, you know. I mean, like every city in California, or every town in California, especially the beach towns, had Jeff Spicoli, at least one of them. And it's just, it's so funny. And God, I can only imagine how much fun it would be to, what was it like, did you happen to work with Phoebe Cates? Because I know you didn't have any scenes together, at least I don't remember any.
No, I didn't work with her, but we all hung out. Mm-hmm. I mean, because obviously this was so long ago, pre-cell phones.
Right.
We all hung out together in between scenes and talked. And, you know, and Phoebe was so exotic because she was such a famous teen model, and she lived in New York, and she dated an older man. And I was just like, oh, and she's stunning,
yes,
gorgeous, so sweet and kind and thoughtful, and, you know, and Jennifer was so lovely. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun to, you know, because we were all kids, and it was a really fun, you know, way to, I don't know, I got to see a little bit outside my little world of Hollywood and Manhattan Beach. And yes, she's just so beautiful and so lovely. And I was going to say, when you're talking about West High and stuff, we used to play them in, I went to Aviation High, which is torn down now. And then my brother went to MiraCosta, but my little brother, but most of my friends went to Bishop Montgomery. Was still there when you went?
That sounds familiar. Yeah. Because, you know, Torrance is close to Manhattan.
We all went to American Martyrs, the Catholic school in Manhattan Beach. Oh, okay. I don't know if it's still there, but.
Okay. Wow. And then what was I just going to ask you? Okay. Well, let me just go back. I have to tell you, I don't know if you follow Bruno Amato. He's running against Kevin McCarthy, and he's in Yellowstone, which is just funny. And he's been on the show too, which is pretty cool. Yeah.
Get out. No, I didn't know. And he must beat him. He must win.
He must. And he's really, he's so cool. I love him because he's just literally, he's an actor. He's a working actor. I think he came to it late. But you know, he's happy. He's kind of like you, a journeyman actor. And he just decided, because he chose to move to Bakersfield for two reasons. Number one, I think his girlfriend, he was in LA, but his girlfriend lives in Northern California, and he has to be close enough to LA. So he thought, well, you know what? Bakersfield is inexpensive, and, you know, it's closer to my girlfriend. And so that's where Kevin McCarthy, that's his district. And Bruno was just like, you know what? I never wanted to be a politician. But fuck it, man. This guy is a traitor, and somebody's got to run against him. Nobody ever runs against him. So it's so funny.
He's such a traitor.
Yeah, he's such a traitor.
Oh, my gosh. How do I support his campaign? I'll start following him as soon as we hang up.
Okay, yeah, just Bruno Amato. AMATO. And he's such a nice man. You know, he literally wishes that someone with more experience might come along. But I think that, you know, because he just figured, I'm just a person who wants to make a change. And even though I've never been in politics before, this guy's so bad, and if nobody else is going to run against him, I'm going to run against him. And, you know, I think he's also military. I think he was in the Navy a long time ago. So he's got the union kind of background thing. So he obviously he's well versed in what he's doing, but he's certainly somebody who just, you know, there are so many of us, I'm not one of them, but so many of us that because of Donald Trump, people are like, I'm just getting in the race. I got to get in the race because this is ridiculous. And yeah, but yeah, he's in Yellowstone and he posts really cool Instagrams. Although he told me he was on my show before and he's like, my Instagram is private. Cause I told him he should like, everybody should go to your Instagram. He's like, but it's private. Okay, fine. But he's so cute.
Just so you know, though, what's funny about that is that my Instagram was private till about a year and a half ago because I didn't even know it was private. I was like, oh, I guess I should open this up. So,
oh my God, that's funny.
But I am gonna follow him and support him, and I don't have any political aspirations, but I do like screaming at the top of my lungs.
Yes,
about,
me too.
And banging the gavel and pounding the drum. And I like to try in my own little way to amplify the people that I think are out there telling the truth and you know, trying to save our country and our democracy. And I know that I have people in my life that are like, that's an exaggeration.
Yeah.
We've got guardrails for these things.
No,
and we're
we
like,
don't.
No, we don't.
No, we don't.
We don't. Our guardrails aren't good enough. We're one more, you know, wild turn on the icy road away from.
Like, yeah. And I mean, it's demise. Like, it doesn't take. I'm sorry, everybody who's listened to my podcast for years. You've heard this story. I'm not going to go into it. But I used to live in Soviet Russia. And my father was a ABC News cameraman. So I had that experience in 1981. And what that showed me is a nation filled with people who are they were living in a prison. Now, I don't think we're going to turn into that. But we're going to basically turn into a modern day Russia, an oligarchy, an authoritarian oligarchy, if the right wingers get their way. And like you're saying, there are so many people that think, oh, that'll never happen here because it's never happened here. And they don't have that experience. And it's like, well, you know what? There are all kinds of things that have never happened. And then all of a sudden they happen. you know, it's like there's a first time for everything. And so we have this American experiment. And again, I'm going to repeat myself, but Kamala Harris said on Inauguration Day, democracy has to, it's not something that's guaranteed. You have to fight for it every day. And unfortunately, our country is just turning into, I mean, did you see the movie Don't Look Up?
Yes.
I mean, that's who we are. You know, well, whether you like the movie or not, it's who we are.
It's that, and I think it's Idiocracy too.
Yes.
I just feel like there's some sort of shaming intelligence and praising ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and people have a right to be stupid. I mean, like, whatever. It's
But you shouldn't be in control of things.
Yes, and that now, and then also the stripping women of rights is that should be the biggest red flag of anybody talking about our democracy right now, because that's one of the first things people do is subjugate women.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're in control of the breeding process.
Yes.
And then we just start losing other rights. And I just find that we're teetering on this knife edge right now.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
I feel very concerned.
Yeah, I'm really concerned. And I try to avoid, because I am kind of, my mother calls me the crack of doom. And for good reason. And, you know, and it's always like I'm always assuming the worst. And so lately, in the last couple of years, I've been working on that, trying not to make these assumptions, because I've been playing around, and I have this other show that's just for patrons only called What's Up. A lot of the time I talk about my more of a, it's kind of like my spiritual journey, for lack of a better way to describe it. And I don't only talk about that. I talk about whatever I fucking, sometimes I do political rants, but I talk about intentional manifesting. And basically that's just the idea that we all have these beliefs and assumptions, and those beliefs and assumptions create our reality. We have certain thoughts, those thoughts make us feel a particular way, and then we seek out what we believe to be true, and we dismiss what we don't believe. And it kind of goes back to the idea of you know, I like to use this example in talking about intentional manifesting and talking about these limiting beliefs that human beings, we put on ourselves. That, like, I watched this documentary, I think it was called The Last Blockbuster. It was The Last Blockbuster Store. There was this guy, he was an actor, and he was talking about it and saying, you know, I was an actor and I'd been on like 85 auditions and I hadn't gotten anything. And then the first thing I got was this Blockbuster commercial, and then I never had a regular job again. And so what I take from that is that so many people would say, you know what, I went on 60 auditions and I never got anything. I'm not meant to be an actor. They believe it. While if, you know, this guy, if this guy would have said at the 60th audition, hey, I'm not booking anything, I'm never going to make it. That's an assumption that he's created based on these experiences that told him, one, you know, you didn't get it this time, but he waited, and on that 86th audition, he got it. And then his life changed and he did what he wanted to do. And so I think that carries over into the collective. We make these collective assumptions, and it drives me fucking nuts when I see Twitter doomers. You know, yes, I am the crack of doom, but I also recognize that if we keep projecting, if we keep putting it out there that Democrats are going to lose, that creates an expectation, it creates a belief, and then we fulfill it. We wind up fulfilling it because that's the narrative that we're living by now. And it's like, I just won't do it. I'm afraid. I'm terrified. I know what could happen to this country. And it's like, if it does turn in the direction of authoritarian, my boyfriend and I, for our livings, we do our political podcasts. And right. I don't know that I could do that anymore. And I don't even know what the hell's going to happen. And, you know, so it's like, I try when I'm online, when I'm not being sarcastic and screaming at Ted Cruz, it's like I try to, and you know, tell people, let's not jump to the assumption because it's not over yet. You know, like this whole thing with the Voting Rights Act, which is scaring the shit out of me, and I really despise Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, but it's like there is an opportunity that the Democrats have to do a talking filibuster, so it's not getting rid of it, it's not even a carve-out, it's just they all have to stand there. I think a certain amount of them would have to stand there, 40 of them or whatever, and talk and talk and talk until they can kill the bill. And I don't think they can do that. And I think the talking filibuster is still something we can utilize and perhaps see these bills pass. Until you know, and we only have a certain period of time to get rid of gerrymandering. We're going to need some time. So I think if we don't have this by the summer, then I'll start, you know, getting in a fetal position and sucking my thumb.
That makes me feel a little bit hopeful, what you just said.
Yeah.
You know, where I go, okay, tiny bit.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I'm going on that hope too, because I remember in 2020, there were so many people who said Trump's going to win. And it's like, I'm not going there. I don't know that he's going to win. He might win, but I'm not jumping to that assumption. Because I think, you know, our thoughts are things, and our thoughts are very powerful. And when enough of us have that same thought, it's manifest destiny. We create it ourselves. And so I'm just going on that thing where it can be, and I don't talk about this too much, but I have a friend who's psychic, and she said to me, and like, I used to call her when I was younger. Basically, I would call her about guys, and I just wanted to pacify her because I was anxious and I wanted answers, and whatever answer she would give me, it never satisfied me, but it was just literally a pacifier to shut me up for that minute, and then I would, you know, quiet down, and then I would feel anxious later and call her later. Anyway, right. So I've remained friends with her, and I don't really have psychic readings with her anymore, but I do ask her about politics, and she was correct in 2016. She thought Trump would win, and she was correct in 2020. She kept insisting that Biden was going to win. And the funny thing was, she didn't really follow politics. So she didn't know names. She knew of Joe Biden, but she didn't like know senators' names, and she wasn't following at all. So before Kamala, I think it was before and after Kamala decided she was going to drop out of the primary, my friend kept saying, I see a light-skinned black woman. And I would ask her about the presidency. And she'd say, I see a light. And I'm like, well, there is Kamala Harris, and she's running. And then she dropped out. And I'm like, but she dropped out. She goes, I don't know. I keep seeing her. I don't know what she's going to do, but I just keep seeing her. And then obviously Joe Biden chose her to be his running mate. And now she's the vice president. And so now my friend is insisting that we're going to be okay.
Oh.
And I mean, obviously it's with a grain of salt, she's been wrong. So, but she's been right politically more than she's been wrong. In fact, I don't even think she's been wrong politically. So she insists, because the other day I called her and I was really freaking out. And she goes, what do you think is going to happen? And I said, I'm terrified that we're going to lose Social Security. We're going to lose Medicaid. We're going to lose voting rights. There's never going to be a fair election. I'm not going to be able to do my job. And she just said very, very, very matter-of-factly, that's not going to happen. And I said, are you saying that because you just think that, or you feel that psychically? And she said, I feel it psychically. And I'm like, okay, I'll call you in a week and ask you the same question. So I'm just trying to go with that.
You know what? I feel like drastic times require drastic measures. Yes. And sometimes we just need our psychic to tell us that everything is going to be okay.
And it is with the grain
of
salt. It is with the grain of salt because, you never know. But I will say this about her. I mean, she's been wrong. She's definitely been wrong. But there was this one guy that I was going out with and we broke up. And I was just, of course, I was a mess. I was in my 30s. And I think I knew that he had a girlfriend, or I think she told me that he had a girlfriend. I can't remember what it was, but I told her, I don't want to know. I don't want to know the details. And I please don't tell me the details. And then one night she calls me up. She's like, okay, I just have to tell you what I see. And it was about this girlfriend. And I mean, I'm telling you, she told me how they met, what her profession was, what color her hair was, the length of her hair. There was a number of other details, and it was like, it drove me nuts because I had all this information and I didn't know if it was true. So I called him up, and he was used to me calling him because I was obsessed and I bugged him constantly. But I called him up and I said, are you seeing someone? And he said, yes. And so I said, did you meet her when you were working? Yes. Does she have shoulder-length brown hair and, like, longer paws? Yes. And I'm like, is she a nurse? And he goes, how do you know this? And I'm like, I'm sure he thought, like, I hired a private investigator or something. And I lied, and I go, I just had a dream. But it wasn't. And every single thing she said, and it was like, I couldn't have known this because I didn't know. So it wasn't like she was fishing it out of me. It was just she got this vision or whatever you want to call it, and she just was totally right on the mark. But again, I mean, she's not 100%.
Right.
I called so many psychics when I was young. I called about my acting career. I called about men. It was just basically, like I said, it was a pacifier to my anxiety and wanting questions answered immediately. And
It's wanting somebody that I've imbued with authority and power to mm-hmm. tell me everything's going to be okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I have to say, and I too have been to many psychics, much to the chagrin to the Catholics in my family who think I'm talking to the devil.
Yes,
but I'm like, yeah, maybe. I don't know. but I've had so few ever say anything that was true. And so the two times in my life where literally every single thing happened that the two said mm-hmm. shocked the shit out of me to where I was like, oh my God, I was like afraid to go back to them. I was like, that was crazy.
Wow.
But most of the time when I was younger, they would all say, well, you're going to have two kids. You're going to be married. You're going to da, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, not married. And gladly so. I am an independent woman.
Me
I do
too.
It with Steven, but I no kids. I leave that to people that have a more stable lifestyle than I do, which is, traveling around all the time and working unmarried. And not that you have to be married to have kids, but my desire to create a family was a more traditional mm-hmm. picture, mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean it has to be that way at all. But
right,
I,
it's
so
what
I
you
was
like,
well, I'm not married, and I don't know. I just thought, it's not my. I come from a big family. I have a million nieces and nephews who I live for, and they know they're going to take care of me when I'm old, along with their parents. So I'm totally taken care of.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I don't have any either, and I mean, I could talk to you forever. It's already been an hour and 10 minutes. And like, I haven't even touched on Silverado or all these other things. So that just means you're just going to have to come back. And we can talk about those things at another time. But it's just so easy talking to you. You're just like Jody. And I had a feeling, because it was funny. Jody had said, you know, hey, you should check out Amanda for your show. And I said, is she a good talker? That's always what I want. I want a good talker. And she's like, oh, yeah, she's a great talker. And so and when Jody's on the show, I mean, it could easily go into 2 hours. And, you know, it's like I'm trying to keep my shows from going into 2 hours because that's a long fucking podcast for people to listen to. Okay. So, but I mean, I could totally talk to you all day long because it's so fun. And I knew that I would because I figured we're both Gen Xers. We both had this experience and I desperately miss California. I lived in California for a long time and now I'm back on the East Coast because both of my aging parents are here. And I just figured, plus my boyfriend, his parents are here. So it just made sense. And
actually envious of you. Stephen and I talk. Stephen does mostly theater. I know mm-hmm. we need to go. And so he's back east. We have a tiny, tiny apartment in New York. I mean, tiny.
How fun.
I'm like, let's just do it. He's from back east. I'm California. I'm like,
yeah.
I don't want to grow old in Los Angeles or older. Wait, look at, see, that's, I, you know what, I think I'm 19 till I look in the mirror and I'm like,
Well, don't we
remember,
all?
Remember, stop being surprised by it.
We all, well, you know what, I totally, my mom always used to say, I don't want to grow old in Los Angeles. And then she moved up to Northern California, and of course I followed her and lived there for a while. And then she decided she was going to move back here because it was just more, she could buy a home and retire. So that was her thing, and she moved out here in 2018. So I follow, or 2017. I followed her in 2018, and I'm from Maryland originally. We went out to California in 77. I was 9 years old, and so it's weird to be back because, in some ways, I really like it. I really love the change of seasons. I hate the summertime more than you could ever know because it's humid and it's fucking awful. And I hate mosquitoes and I hate the bugs and the oppressive humidity that never ends. And, I, you know, as a hormonal woman, I moved back here, you know, during my menopause. So I'm, you know, the hot flashes mixed with humidity is like my own personal hell. At least I don't have the hot flashes anymore. But I hate it. But I love the fall. And I do really enjoy the winter, even when it's dark and dank, because I know endless humid summer is coming. So I try to, like, embrace every day. It's like my boyfriend, who is, again, he's from Virginia, and he lived in Pennsylvania for a long time. He lived in Hawaii for about 5 years and then went to California, and now he's back here. So he spent a lot of his time on the East Coast, and it's like, well, it's funny. We'll wake up in the morning, and it'll just be gray, and we'll open the blinds, and he'll go, another beautiful day. I'm like, but it is, because it's not humid.
I know. My hair's too frizzy for the humid weather, but you know what? I'll take it. I'll take it if that's where we end up.
Yeah, well, I mean, every place is going to have something good to offer. And, you know, I always wonder when we are no longer with parents, because we're fortunate enough to have all of our parents at this point. But, you know, at some point that's going to change. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't know that I would go back to California, but maybe New York, maybe. That could be fun. So we'll see.
It could totally be fun.
Yeah, it could be cool.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Jody and I are going to have to take a trip to come visit you when it's safe to fly. Because I just read the 5G thing, how they're saying it's going to ground all the planes. Yes. I was like, good God almighty, it just has to stop. Everybody needs to take a breath and calm the fuck down.
Yes. Oh, my God. That would be super, super fun. That would be so much fun. All right. Well, I am going to let you go. Did you have something to say? I interrupted
you. No. Just thank you for having me on your show. And it was wonderful to speak with you and hear your stories.
Well, if you were here, I'd give you a hug. But of course, it would be a safe COVID-tested hug.
So it would be a COVID-tested hug.
And again, I had so many questions for you that I didn't even get to. So I hope one day you can come back. But before I let you go, make sure to let everybody know where to find you, specifically your Twitter handle, or if you have any website or anything like that.
My Twitter is _ Amanda Wiss, and Instagram is Amanda Wiss, and I have a website, amandawiss.com. It's really nothing exciting.
And well, it's interesting. I'm watched it.
A little TV series called The Resonator that's going to start on Amazon Prime.
Awesome. Sometime. And see, that was one of the questions I had. Any future projects coming up? So there's that. I'm going to actually, is there any other projects that are coming up for you that people should be aware of?
No, just The Resonator is the only one that's solid right now.
And when is that available?
It'll be available in a couple of months, I think.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Of course, you can always find me on Twitter, Author Kimberly with the L-E-Y. Don't forget that extra E at the end of my name. And all my books are on Amazon. Amanda, it was super awesome talking to you. Thank you so much.
Right back at you, and thank you for having me.
Oh, of course, anytime. All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Liberty sees me, it stands by me, and celebrates me for who I am.
When I come into the office, I feel that I belong here.
I don't have to be corporate America Gabby. I can just bring Gabby to work.
Reach your potential and find a job you love at Liberty Mutual. We offer development training, rich benefits, and a culture that lets you bring your whole self to work, so you can pursue your tomorrow today. Ready to consider a career at Liberty Mutual? Find out how at libertymutualcareers.com.